On this episode of Still Loading.
Everyone, and welcome to this new episode of the Still Loading Podcast, the Christmas episode of the Still Loading Podcast. Well, Christmas Eve. I am your host, Josh Koval. Thank you all so much for listening. This episode is a very special one to me. Joining me today to discuss our topic, which you can see in the title, I'm assuming, but we'll go into that a little bit more. But joining me to discuss the living books, as they are called, is my wonderful, beautiful wife, Courtney. Courtney, how are you doing today?
Hello, Josh. I am your wife. I am doing well.
Oh, thank God that didn't change since last time.
No, it did not. We are still good.
Oh, you're still stuck with me.
Still stuck. Here I am. But yeah, we're doing good. We're in the podcast room and we're doing a podcast together.
Yes, we are. And we are here to talk about, like I said, the living books. And we're going to get into what living books... Actually, you know what? I had it a little bit later, but I think it's better to shout it... Not shout it out, but to discuss it off the top so listeners know what they're in store for. What are living books? Well, the living books was a series of edutainment titles that came out in the 90s, published by Broderbund and a bunch of other companies. The license got bought between like five or six different companies. Like, seriously, if you go on the Wikipedia and you see how many different companies like had their hands in the pie on this thing, it's at least six or seven, possibly eight different companies that owned the license to this game, to the series, which is just wild to think about. So we are going to be talking about this series because it means a lot to me. I played the living books a lot as a kid and I really enjoyed them. And I wanted to have you on because Courtney, for those who don't know, went to school for early childhood education. And these games are very specifically geared towards early childhood. And, you know, maybe a little bit older too, depending on the kid, if they like it. So I wanted to have her on to talk about like what she sees and the positives about them, the things that they could improve on, that kind of thing. So yeah, Courtney, thank you once again. Now, before we dive into talking about living books, I want the listeners to get to know us a little bit better. What is our background on edutainment titles? So Courtney, I'm going to throw it over to you. What is your experience with like educational games or educational software as a kid, or even as an adult when you were a teacher? So go for it. What's your experiences?
So first off, I want to let everybody know that, yes, I do have a degree in early childhood education. I went to our local community college and received my associate's degree in early education, birth through fourth grade. And I had been a childcare and preschool teacher for about 10 years before we had our daughter. And I have since been staying home and raising her, as my own personal student and child. And it's been a great experience to have all of this kind of background and experience in early childhood and now just being able to fulfill these dreams of parenthood. And I recall a lot of edutainment games as kind of my only source of video games. My video game experience does not stem too far from that base layer. When I was a small child in the 90s, we had the family PC.
As you do.
That's right. And we had one of those really old school computer desks that held all of the giant bricks of the computer. And, you know, I recall going upstairs to our computer room and asking my mom or dad to turn it on and wait until it turned on and then wait again for it to load.
Still loading. Perfect.
Perfect. Yeah.
It was all in the books and you didn't even realize it was you were destined for this.
It's fate. It's fate. From the very beginning of my video gaming experience, it was still
because
loading.
You had a slow computer like everyone else in the 90s. You were destined to get on to still loading.
That's it. And then this is it. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was all.
All right. We'll see you later, folks. Now, sorry, go on.
I recall being a wee child of maybe 5 or 6 and my mom turning on Reader Rabbit or Jumpstart. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I'm more fond of the adventure games that veered off of education a little bit more and more into character and adventure sort of stories. Mm-hmm. But I do recall, you know,
the most famous reindeer of all.
Obviously, no, sorry. Rudolph and Olive, the other reindeer, you know.
Oh my God. I was like, Olive. Oh, Olive, the other reindeer.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a book, actually. Olive,
wait, really?
The other reindeer.
It's
yes. I've read it.
The other reindeer.
That's correct. Olive. O-L-I-V-E.
Okay. I did not know they made a book out of that pun.
Well, when you're in preschool and childcare, you get around to the library and you read a lot. Mm-hmm. But before I could read in the 90s, like I was saying, you know, we would go and we'd load up the old PC and put in Jumpstart or Reader Rabbit or Math Blasters.
Which I remember you saying you hated.
Oh, gosh, I hated that. That was during my grade school era. Mm-hmm. Very early, you know, blasting the little rocks with what's 2 plus 2? 4. You know, 4 plus 4 is 8. 6 minus 2, stuff like that. And, you know, some of the later games would get a little more difficult. Obviously, as you're progressing through your education, you want it to become more challenging and expand on your base knowledge that you've already acquired. So division was my downfall. And I have such stressful memories of the one villain of Math Blasters. You know, my time ran out on the game and I did not complete whatever task it was. And this whiny little brat of a boy or alien or something came on the screen and says to me, you know, my grandma can do that equation and she's old. And I literally remember yelling at this block computer screen saying, yeah, well, she should. Because she's old and has had time to learn this stuff.
I like how your insult isn't really an insult. You're like, she's more experienced.
That's right. It's factual. Of course she's going to get it right. If your grandma did not know division,
I'd be a little concerned.
We would have some questions for Granny. But yeah, I mean, those are kind of my edutainment game memories. I, you know, recall playing other things like Mr. Potato Head's Adventure to some valley or Veggie Valley. Like, that's my favorite. Still, I would say along the edutainment sort of area, but more along the lines of story building, sequencing, and recall, and, you know, the mini games within that were always fun. And we also had another game. I think it was one of the Toy Story CD-ROMs that we would pop in and it would play through the movie and you would do different mini games in Andy's room. Like, what was it? Playing blackjack with Ham because he played cards.
That just
with
doesn't, that
Mr.
does
Potato
not
Head.
Seem kid appropriate.
Well, no, it wasn't. I always lost. I never know how to win that game because I'm 7. And I don't know how to play blackjack. You're playing cards and I know some of the numbers and I don't know the difference between a club and a spade because they're both black. So I'm just clicking the cards and waiting to see, does Ham the piggy bank get upset or does he get really happy that he won over me. Most of the time he won over me because I just kept clicking the card to draw another card and I didn't understand it. So that bit of education failed me. So no, I don't gamble or play competitive cards.
It might be a good thing that you that you didn't pass your education in gambling.
Correct. Correct. But later in that game specifically, you know, there were little video clips and you could play them out of order or sequence them in order. And there were memorizing games like sequencing Pizza Planet and stuff. And, you know, that was really exciting for me. And I think exciting for my parents, too, because it was the mid to late 90s at that point. Mm-hmm. And I feel like they were really on the cusp. We were all really on the cusp of edutainment. Technology was developing and, you know, my mom, a businesswoman, was getting access to a lot of these handy tech things like the BlackBerry or a cell phone or a Palm Pilot, all these things for her work. Yeah. And, you know, she's like, yeah, we have a computer and I have educational games for the kids and stuff. And I think it was exciting for her, too. For my parents, too, to say that their kids played like video games and stuff, because that was still really new.
Yeah.
Especially in their like circle, their community that they were a part of. And, you know, my younger sister came along 6.5 years later. So the edutainment game really kind of stepped up by then.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time we were in the early to mid 2000s, Leapfrog started coming out and Leapstart or something, mm-hmm. and all of those different gadgets.
There's a lot of different things that
many. There are so many variations of what Leapfrog gave us. You know, there was that whole pad where you could put your books in and the pen that you would touch each word and the machine, the technology would read to you. You would press the pictures and mm-hmm. it could tell you what was on that page. And it was like really magical for even myself at that point, being, you know, 10 or close to adolescence. But seeing my sister being a part of different types of PC games and Leapfrogs and handheld devices. It was a really cool shift in technology to see how it had already advanced over just such a short amount of time.
Did she have a Leapster, like the little handheld?
Oh, yes, that's
things?
What it was called. It was a Leapster. Okay. And we got it, and it was like for car rides because my parents at the time were still really into antiquing.
I remember
the weekends,
these stories, yes.
We would drive really far away, and my brother and I would have our Game Boy colors and my sister would have her Leapster. And, you know, that's like the height of all of our video gaming.
That was like the height of your gaming
experience.
Exactly.
After that, we didn't get any new handhelds. We didn't get any new devices until like the Wii U came out.
Not even. It was just the Wii.
I
actually inherited that because you guys didn't care about it anymore.
That's right. Like, we didn't. It was just like, well, we can go play outside. Why would we do it inside? Mm. Sort of thing. Like, that's just how my family personally was brought up.
You mean you got exercise?
Yeah. Yes.
As opposed to me, who was like 10 years old, I got my N64. I'm like, all right, friends, neighbors, not talking to you anymore.
See
There's
you next
Donkey
year.
Kong.
That's right.
I mean, that's funny. For myself, with edutainment titles, I grew up with Living Books, like I said, but I also did play a little bit of, like, I remember my neighbor had Zumbinis.
That was a really fun one. Was that also a game played at school?
You could play it at school,
I think I recall playing it at school. I remember a couple of games, like Word Munchers or Number Munchers or something,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego?
Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
That one was so hard for me. I did not do it.
Geography is a tough subject.
I never. I don't.
I'm not good at it.
Not
I still am
sure not. How I got through middle school, by not knowing how to read a map.
Really?
But yeah. Yeah. My social studies class grades, not the best.
Well, social studies is an odd subject, too, because it's like history, but also at the same time, geography. It's
a combination of all these things that did not interest me. But yeah, word munchers, that was good.
Mm-hmm.
Typing Tutor 7, I rocked that. Mavis Beacon.
What about Hot Dog Stand? You ever play Hot Dog Stand?
That sounds familiar, but I don't think I played Hot Dog Stand.
It's basically just a business simulation game. Where
I did not like that.
You set the prices of hot dogs, and you have to see if you can bring up your business and stuff like that.
I think we played something like that in high school business class, and I failed that miserably. that was not my thing.
You don't have a mind for business?
Nope, not at all.
Fair enough. I played Living Books a lot as a kid. I loved Living Books so much. We had Green Eggs and Ham. We also had, I think Cat in the Hat was one of the ones we had as well.
But Living Books, is that just on the computer or does that also have a separate console to play it off of?
It was just on computer as far as I'm aware of. Gotcha. Now you can get it on tablets and phones and smartphones.
Naturally.
And now actually... Shout out to the Zoom platform. Zoom platform is a company that it's basically an online store where you can download computer games DRM free. They sent me review codes of four Living Book games that we're going to be talking about today to kind of highlight the series. And just to be clear, it's not Zoom as in like the video communication tool that we've all used since the pandemic started. It's called Zoom Platform, and you can check them out on Twitter.
It's also not the really cool kids television show that you would sometimes
catch.
Come on
and Zoom. Come on.
That's right. Catch it after school. Hit me up. Come on and Zoom.
That's right. So on Twitter, it's at Zoom Platform, all one word. And their website is zoom-platform.com. They have a whole bunch of obscure old PC titles you can check out there. You can buy them on there. There's no client to download, so you just buy them straight from the website and download. But they were nice enough to send me review codes for these four games that we're going to highlight, like I said. And just wanted to make sure I shout them out because I was very kind of them to do so. And I put in for these review codes, and I honestly probably wouldn't have if I didn't have such a strong connection to Living Books. This wasn't something where a company reached out to me asking me to promote their stuff. This was something where I'm like, I love these games. I loved them ever since I was a kid. So when I saw that they were looking for content creators to talk about this, I had to jump on it. So I'm very grateful they approved my request, and here we are.
Thank you, Zoom.
Now, if only they were tied with the big Zoom company, we could, you know, get a little bit of scratch on the side for this. You know what I'm saying?
Ooh, I think I know what you're saying.
You know what I'm saying. So let's dive into this, shall we? We're going to talk about the Living Books games that we are here to discuss. So there are four games that they sent me for review codes. They sent me Arthur's Teacher Trouble, Arthur's Birthday,
Reading Race.
Thank you. Arthur's Reading Race and Arthur's Computer Adventure. And those four games, it actually has a really nice snapshot of what Living Books kind of grew to be, because Arthur's Teacher Trouble was their second ever title released, the first one being one of Mercer Mayer's like Monster and Me things or whatever they are.
The Little Critters?
I think that's what they are, you're right.
The Shaggy Hedgehog Boy and His Family.
That's exactly it.
Little Critters, I believe.
The title was just Grandma and Me was the name of their first one. And then it's not their final one, but it's one of their final ones. The Arthur's Computer Adventure was one of their latest, like oldest releases, more recent releases. And that, by that, I mean, it came out in the late 90s, as opposed to Arthur's Teacher Trouble came out in the early 90s. So Mark Schlichting is the one who created Living Books. It was the brainchild of him. And the idea originally came from when he was a kid and he was reading Dr. Seuss books, and he would read Horton Hears a Who and wanted to play like the trumpets in the background. He wished he could interact with the other items on the screen and or on the page, excuse me, and kind of see a little bit more of the world that Dr. Seuss created. And that idea stuck with him for a while. And in 1988, he was doing contract work as a digital illustrator for Broderbund, where he actually did some of the early illustration stuff for Where in the World is Carmen Sandiego? You got to sing it every time. Maybe not every time. I'm sure
maybe not every time.
we'll stop here. So he ended up going on full time with Broderbund, and he wanted to create some type of educational program because he saw his kids playing on their NES, their Nintendo, and being frustrated by the lack of educational stuff for it. They were always playing, you know, Mario or Contra or Zelda or something like that. I don't know if those games specifically, I'm just obviously using them as examples, but he decided to kind of take matters into his own hands, and he pitched it to Broderbund. He wanted to see if they would be willing to do something like this, and they gave him the green light. They gave him their blessing, and he had a couple of months to kind of put stuff together, put ideas together, and they ended up creating a template, and they ended up creating a little engine, which ended up being what you saw as Living Books. They were trying at one point in time, they did obviously get the Dr. Seuss license, and the way they actually got it, they had a meeting with Dr. Seuss's widow. I'm going to blank on her name because it was Ted Geisel was Dr. Seuss's real name. And Audrey was his wife's name. And they met Audrey. And at the time, they had a deal with, I think it was Random House Publishing, I want to say. And Random House was on the verge of losing the Dr. Seuss license. She wasn't sure if she wanted to stick with them or not. So they brought in Mark and his team to kind of show like what they could do. They have, you know, this working relationship with Broderbund, and through this connection, you know, we could take your husband's books and turn them into this educational game. And he came in, he did a whole presentation. She didn't say much, apparently. And then at the end of the presentation, she just walked up to him, took his arm around hers, and basically said, I like this. I'm going to stick with this. We're going to go out. We're going to go have dinner. You can all come if you'd like. And then they just walked out and had dinner. And that was apparently the done deal.
Sounds like the easiest business meeting ever.
Seriously, right? And that's how they got the Dr. Seuss license. And it's kind of cool to see that like, you know, it was so successful. And when the first one came out, it went beyond their wildest expectations. And in fact, it was the reason he even got contacted is because one of the higher ups from Random House saw one of the Living Books games at like a store, and a demo of it was playing at a kiosk, and they fell in love with it. So that's when they reached out, and that's how this whole thing came to be. There's a lot more to Living Books. Like, there is a massive amount of information both on the Wikipedia, which is a good overview, but there's a lot of sources. There was a lot, whoever wrote that Wikipedia page did a lot of digging. There's a lot of sources. There's a lot of great information on Wonderful's page. Wonderful is the, besides the Zoom platform, I believe actually the company that owns the Zoom platform that, you know, that I mentioned earlier, I believe they own the rights to Living Books, or they own a license to it, because Wonderful is now the company that was created by a bunch of former Living Books employees to basically take back the Living Books license and republish them on new platforms. So I'm not quite sure actually if the people at Zoom platform own Living Books or if they just have a license to use Living Books, because Wonderful still does as well. And Wonderful is the company that has taken all these Living Books games and ported them over to tablets and phones and all that good stuff. And the guy who did that, the guy who founded Wonderful, wasn't Mark Schlichting, which was the creator of Living Books, but Mickey Mantle, no relation to the baseball player. Mickey Mantle was the chief technical officer of Broderbund back in the 90s. He actually worked on Myst, which I will actually hopefully be doing an episode on soon. I finally beat it somewhat recently on Twitch. So that's a little hint for you all that there might be a missed episode coming if I can get my act together. Myst is a great game. I really enjoyed it. But anyway, we'll save that for the missed episode. But Mickey brought the whole gang back together to create Wonderful, and now you can play them on your tablets, you can play them on your cell phones, like I said before, and now you can play them on Steam because Zoom brought them over to Steam, and that you can also get a bunch of them on the Zoom platform website as well. And the last thing I'll shout out real quick before we kind of talk about the games in earnest is that Mickey Mantle, I actually had on the podcast. I had him on a couple years ago to talk about it. The original plan was to have both him and Mark Schlichting on, and I was in contact with Mark, but just stuff fell through and it just never came to fruition, which is a bummer. But Mickey was still nice enough to give me a bunch of his time and had a wonderful conversation. You can listen to that. I should have probably looked up the episode number for that, but I will I'll look that up right now and I can shout it out. But yeah, so that's about all I got for the intro for this. And the episode with Mickey Mantle, by the way, y'all, was episode 210, which came out on January 16th, 2022. So it'll be almost 2 years old shortly after this episode drops. Courtney, are you ready to talk about the games after my long-winded solo rant?
Oh, yeah.
No, are you good?
Yeah, I'm ready. I was just thinking about how this room that we're in makes me a little sleepy.
Does it make you sleepy?
Yeah. Also, it's really late, but...
It's 8:30.
Okay. As a parent, that's really late.
You're not wrong.
Our child asleep, that is precious time. And I'm here spending it with you.
Yeah, because you like me.
Yeah, I do. We're friends. We're really good friends.
We're good friends. You know, we like each other.
Yeah, we do.
We like each other. We spend time together.
Yeah, mutual, I'm sure.
Mutual. Mutual, I'm sure.
Should we just try to see how many Christmas quotes
we can get?
Just any Christmas movie quotes we can squeeze into this episode?
I fit like 2.5 years worth of Home Alone references into every Captain N episode.
What?
Because the main character in Captain N is called Kevin. So every time, once per episode, I'd always yell, Kevin!
Kevin's not here.
Kevin's not here.
Kevin's not here.
Buzz! All right. So the four games we got review codes for are Arthur's Teacher Trouble, Arthur's Birthday, Arthur's Reading Race, and Arthur's Computer Adventure. Courtney.
That's me.
Could you explain to the listeners here what exactly, how do living books work? Like in the general play of it, how does living books work? What do you do with it? What do you do in them?
Living books is essentially a read-along story built for the computer, for your PC, where, you know, you pop in your disk and on the screen pops up an Arthur book, specifically is the one that we took a dive into, and you click on either read the story to me or play through the game. You have options usually, and it opens like a book on your screen, and in the beginning, a narrator's voice will come on and read the text on the screen. And while the narrator is reading, the text will highlight so you can follow along as well. Now, after the passage is read, there is a pause for you to explore that page of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use your mouse to click on objects in the pictures. You can click on specific words from the text on the page that will be repeated and highlighted to you. And it was really fun to kind of take a step back and be kind of the child in this experience, someone reading to us, being the explorer of the page and diving into an immersive story.
Mm-hmm.
And so you continue throughout the story, turning the pages, having the text read to you, and being able to have the freedom to click around, explore the page before turning the next page and continuing on with the story. Within each Living Books game, usually, especially in the later books, you have options to play mini games. Sometimes they pop up as you're reading through the story. And other times you can access these mini games from the title page where it says play the games. So there's quite a few different options, especially in the more recently published games, like Arthur's Computer Adventure. Lots of mini games.
There's like four or five on there. It's a lot.
It is. It's very immersive. And I think especially that one does a great job because it is about computer adventure games. And it's just really doing a great job of pulling you into that moment, utilizing the computer as the game itself.
It adds to the aesthetic of it.
The aesthetic and the experience as a whole. Mm. Whereas the first several published games are more of a read-to-me storybook, which is just as wonderful and targets an even younger age with its simplicity. Overall, The Living Books is an experience of being read to, as well as having some independence of reading them as an early reader yourself.
No, you mean for your kid or yourself.
Or your child or yourself. Child. I put myself
No shade thrown on anyone who's learning, you know, mm-hmm. learning to read. Like, legitimately, there's adults who learn to read. And there's actually, fun fact, there were adults who learned to read through this that Mickey told me about, but not because necessarily they didn't have enough education. It's because they used English as a second language. It was English as a second language.
That's wonderful. And that's really what we like to hear.
Isn't that cool? Like, mm-hmm. there's people who learned English through Living Books, which is really cool to hear. Yeah, Living Books, I think my favorite part of it, what you described there, is the interactivity thing, because it's not just clicking around on the page. And when we say click around the page, you'll click around on one of the parts of the illustration that's on each page, and they have really fun and unique animations for every single one. Some of them are silly, some of them are not really serious, most of them are silly, or some of them are just kind of general or generic.
And they're
just
all relatively fun. Short. They mm-hmm. take just several seconds of the reader's time. And, you know, say at Arthur's birthday, you click on a bunch of balloons. One of them pops. One of them blows away. You can, you know, click on a fish in a little fishbowl. It'll jump out, do a little mm-hmm. swim around.
Does a diving board thing.
Yeah. If you're in the hallways of a school, in Arthur's school, you can click on a locker and it'll open and shut, or the window will, a bird will fly by. Just really fun, cute little thing, little animations accompanied with whimsical sound effects.
And all the acting is voice acted, or all the stuff is voice acted. Like, so when it reads to you, it is literally reading to you with a voice, but also when you click on the characters to have them interact on the screen, like after it's done being read to you, say you click on Arthur again, or you click on Mr. Ratburn, or you click on someone mm-hmm. else, they have other lines that you might not have heard just when the game reads to you.
Extra quips and comments.
Exactly. And there's always usually something funny. Like, I know we had our daughter play this. We had her play it. And they're in Arthur's Teacher Trouble. There's a scene in the hallway where the principal is showing off the spelling bee trophy. And if you click on there's a trophy with a little dude on top with a baseball bat. And if you click on him, he throws the baseball off and it falls in, it bumps the water fountain, and the water fountain starts spraying water all over a kid right next to him. Mm-hmm. And she just thought that was the funniest thing. She loved watching this kid get sprayed. Also, there, when I first showed it to her, it was the sampler that you can get actually on like iPad and, you know, tablets and phones and whatnot. And in Arthur's birthday, there was these like little like jam jars or something like that. And if you click on them, a little mouse scrolls like comes along the windowsill, and they pick up the bottoms like it's a skirt, and they go,
hey, ho, ha, ha. Oh yeah, and she really loved that one.
Oh, she wanted to keep clicking on it forever and ever till the sound effect drove us nuts.
The kid loves her critters. What can I say?
She does. And it was really kind of cool to see her play with this. Like, her attention span is still pretty short with it. She gets bored, I would say, after about 20-30 minutes, but she's not even three.
Oh gosh, that's how long she'll stay in tune with it. That's yeah. great.
She'll stay pretty much alert for like 20 minutes or so.
But that's with your guidance.
Yeah, that's mm-hmm. yeah.
We don't just leave her alone and say, have at it, here's some screen time.
No, we kind of play together where I will pick something to click on and click on it, then I'll ask her, hey, do you want to click on something? I actually have her practice moving the mouse too.
I've seen that. That's really cute. And she really adores that because I think looking at her, she thinks she's playing just like you or working just like you. And she really loves when you model behaviors and she can imitate them.
She is getting pretty good at the mouse, surprisingly. Like the hardest thing is because the mouse isn't designed for her. You know, they have like kid mouses for computers.
I did not know they had kid mouses.
You didn't at our
like
local
different sizes?
Yeah, a smaller size for their smaller hands.
Oh, that's so cute. Yeah.
At our local library, they have the little kids' computer station. The mouses are smaller there.
Did you know they're turtles?
There's turtles there?
No, no, no. The mouses are turtles.
Oh, the mouses
and
are
you
turtles.
Click on their shells at the library.
That's awesome, actually.
It really is. They always want to play the computer games. And I'm like, no, let's go make a new friend or let's find a book at the library.
Yeah.
You know?
She does a pretty good job considering, like I said, the mouse is way too big for her. So when she tries to move it, she can move it pretty well. But when she tries to click on it, the mouse is too big and she almost ends up pushing it away from what she wanted to click on. So I have to hold the mouse still and then I let her click it.
She just needs a little help.
Just needs a little bit of help.
Just a little bit with her little fingers.
So before we get to the educational part of this, like talking about like what, in your opinion, these games do well and where they can improve, we should talk about the things you mentioned prior, the bonus games in each of them.
Oh, yeah.
We're not like, because listeners, it'd be kind of boring for us to go through beat by beat every single page of all these games because they're meant to be they're meant to be more for kids, and B, it would just be us rattling off a list of all the things you can interact with on the page. That's something, if you guys are interested in this, go discover for yourself because they are fun. Like, it's cute. It's really fun, especially if you have kids. This is worth checking out. But the bonus stuff they add in each game, you can really see how much they have grown in terms of their skill for developing these as these titles went along, both visually and in terms of the gameplay and interactivity. If you look at how Arthur's Teacher Trouble starts, there's some really bare bones animation. It's the visuals are decent. They look well enough, but when you get to Arthur's Computer Adventure, it is like night and day. The visuals, like the animation is so much smoother. They try a lot more risky styles of animation. We actually saw one, we were watching, I want to say it was like one of the Berenstain Bear ones, excuse me.
Oh,
Mandela
pardon
effect.
You.
but like they had like everything was being animated inside a tiny little window. And they had four or five different text lines on the left and right sides of the page. And so every time it would read something, the animation would change and the camera angles were changing up. They did a lot of impressive work considering it was all sprite or it's all like pixel art animations. So Arthur's Teacher Trouble starts off pretty basic. And then by the time you get to the end of it, the sounds are a lot better. The animation's a lot smoother. It's a lot more robust. They have a lot more to offer in each game. So not only both in visuals and sound, but also with these mini games that we're talking about. In Arthur's Teacher Trouble, it's not so much a mini game, but it's more of kind of like it kind of changes it up as opposed to being read to and you exploring around on the page. You get a quiz and you have, it's not even much of a quiz. You see a list of spelling words and the game will spell out the words for you, show you a picture of whatever the word is next to it. So if it's an alligator, they wouldn't have used, that might have been a bit big. But
a cat, C-A-T, they would spell it out to you. They would highlight the letter and then the word as a whole. And then the visual representation of a little cat would animate itself by and do like a little cozy purr and then sit down and you could click on to the next word.
Exactly. And some of them would interact with each other too. So if you clicked on cat, maybe it would see like a ball, like maybe ball was directly above it for B. The cat would look up at the picture of the ball that was used for the word above it and it would swat at it and maybe it would bounce, knock it off the page and then the ball would come back. I can't remember if that actually happened in what we did, but I'm just using that as kind of like a little example. So it was cool because it kind of almost broke the fourth wall a little bit for the kids, seeing like, oh, these interact with things other than just themselves. They'll interact with the other letters of the alphabet, the other words that we're using. So that was really cool. That was Arthur's Teacher Trouble. And then in Arthur's Birthday, there's not any like spelling stuff per se, but there is a matching game where it encourages the kids to click around on the screen and find clues. If they find enough clues, they can then basically at the end of the book, you can then see all the presents that Arthur got from his friends. And based off the clues you find, you can determine which friend gave Arthur which present. So maybe Buster gave Arthur the blue present that's a small rectangle. So you find the present that matches that description, so on and so forth. And if you get it, yay, you win. There's not really much more to it than that. But it's still, I like that because the whole idea of loving books is to be interactive with the storybook. And now you have an incentive other than just exploration to encourage kids to explore around these pages. The fun of exploration is all the animation stuff, but it's also the incentive to be like, I can figure out this puzzle at the end of it. So Courtney, what are the last two mini games for Arthur's Reading Race and Arthur's Computer Adventure?
So Arthur's Reading Race is a game where Arthur bets against DW that she can't read. So she sets out to prove him wrong. And within that story, one of the mini game options is a board game. So we're stepping up from the matching game in the previous game to now a digital board game where Arthur and DW take turns drawing cards that have words on it. And you can choose easy, medium, hard levels that you'd like to play your character at. So this is great for playing with siblings, playing with a parent, playing with a friend, but also obviously you can play against the preset computer selection if you're playing on your own. So the board game is set up over the storyline where it's a race to the end so that you can get your ice cream prize between Arthur and DW betting each other if DW can read or not. So a digital card is drawn and it has a word printed on it. And what the player is supposed to do is read this word or identify what the word is and then click on one of three pictures that represents the word. So if Arthur draws a card and the word is tree, T-R-E-E, it spells, your job is to either read it or decode the word so that you can click the picture of the tree, not the ball or not a picture of a
whatever
cat.
The other items are.
So if you guess correctly, you will be able to move as many spaces on the board game
hopefully you know what a tree is.
Well, you know, early readers, yeah, tree, three, truck. You don't know what they're reading, but then you are rewarded with the amount of spaces as there are number of letters in the word. So Arthur gets the word tree. He moves four spaces, one for each letter. DW picks cat. She has three letters, but she guesses correctly with the correct picture. So she gets to move three spaces. So that's a really fun kind of interactive game.
And the end of it real quick is really amusing because you get to pick your choice of ice cream and all the ice cream flavors at the parlor are nasty as hell.
Why they gotta be known so nasty?
Toenail Crunch was one of them.
Ew.
And let me tell you, the picture was not pleasant. I'm dead serious. It actually made me a little queasy looking at it.
Got you queasing.
It got me queasy. I won't go into it. It was fucking nasty. Anyway, so the last one, Arthur's.
Oh, sorry.
Computer Adventure.
So the board game actually stepped its game up and was implemented in the final Arthur game, the Computer Adventure. There's actually multiple mini games to choose from.
And not just a board game.
I think because the storyline was about this new video game that Arthur borrowed from his friend, and he was a little obsessed over it and really wanted to play it all the time. I think the writers did a great job of immersing you into the story by creating actual mini games based on that computer game that Arthur is playing. His game is
Deep Sea Adventure.
Deep Sea Adventure. Yeah. So it's all underwater themed and, you know, pirates and sharks and bubbles and underwater themes throughout the mini games. So they do have the board game mini game in this computer game as well, in Arthur's Computer Adventure, but they've transposed it into an underwater theme stranded island with treasure board game setup. And I think something fun that they added was, you know, if you land on a certain spot, maybe a sea turtle will push you a couple extra spaces away,
or kind of Shoots and Ladders-esque.
Yeah. Really reminiscent of Chutes and Ladders. Don't step on the pirate X, you might fall down through a hole. But that was just one of the game that you could play on Arthur's Computer Adventure. There were other things like treasure hunting, where you use your arrow keys to make Arthur swim down and avoid sharks and pokey fish or skeleton pirates.
It was kind of clunky with the controls, but it's not really, you know, the game Living Books aren't known for kind of like their
gameplay,
their action, it's more their action for, gameplay,
so right, it's more story based. But it was fun seeing the different types of mini games that they included.
Also the DW one with the money.
That was this one as well. Yeah, so DW ran a little side hustle. She
making nasty ass food.
Well, her initial game was for you to purchase a toy from her toy store and
need clothes for it.
Well, yeah, you had to purchase all of the accessories. And of course, we chose the hardest one, Bionic Bunny and all of his who's its and what's its galore that are attached to him, his Swiss Army knife and his hat and his go-go boots or stuff like that. And when we ran out of pennies to purchase our pieces, our accessories for Bionic Bunny Boy or whatever, we had to go over to the next screen.
Bunny Boy. Sorry. It reminds you of Bubble Man.
Oh, yeah.
A bunny Boy. Sorry, go on.
You have to jump over to the next screen where DW is asking for help to create a stew for her dolly. And we go through a recipe of items that are placed on the floor.
That's generous.
Yeah. Because the items could be like gummy worms or spoonfuls of sugar, but they could also be golf balls.
Yep.
Cans, whole cans of tomato. I want to say like dirt. Like it was just random thing. I think rubber bands were part of it. So you had to click one gummy worm and put that in her bowl. Then you had to click two cans of tomatoes and then three, I don't know, strands of hair. I'm pulling this out of nowhere.
But it was tedious to do so because you can only do it one at a time.
But for a small child, you know, that was ample amount of timing. And she had great reactions when you got the answer correct. And her reaction when you got it wrong was just, eh. It wasn't, no, that's not right. That's not wrong. I'm not going to accept your ingredient. She just goes, eh, sort of thing with a little sideways smirk. And then based on your performance, based on how well you followed the recipe, the dolly would either really love your stew or really hate your stew and gave you the amount of coins according to her review. So if you followed it to a T and she really loved it, you got more pennies to go back over to DW's store and spend them all. Or if she didn't like it, you probably had to do another game because she only gave you one or two pennies.
Yep.
So that was a really fun kind of mathematical twist added into Arthur's Computer Adventure and straying just a little bit into the math world instead of staying straight in their lane of the reading world.
So it leads me to ask you, hon, about your opinion on how these games present the educational side of things. Like, what are they good at? What do you see that they could improve on? Because for me, I would assume they do it really well because it's like they highlight all the words. They go word by word, that you can reread the whole pages if you want to by clicking on the words. So if a kid wants to learn a word, they can click on it multiple times and keep hearing how it's spoken. It encourages them to interact with the pages, so they'll want to come back to it and see what all they can do. I mean, even with our own child, she requests certain pages because she knows what's on them and likes the animations on it. So that's just from my perspective. But I'm, like you said at the beginning, you have a degree in early childhood education. So what do you see in these games?
Well, we have to understand that early literacy is a combination of different skills and knowledge to help children learn how to read. And there's several components that includes, which is both language and writing skills to become a reader.
Mm-hmm.
You have to develop listening comprehension and awareness of print and phonological awareness.
What is phonological awareness?
That's the sound. Phonics.
Okay. For some reason in my head, I heard it as like F-A-U, like it's a fawn. Like
No. Phonics,
okay,
with a
phonics.
P-H.
That makes sense. Okay, phonological.
Yeah.
What is that again? Phonological what?
Phonological awareness is,
okay,
you know, when children start to become aware or learn what words sound like, what certain sounds are familiar and repetitive. And also, you know, they're also learning what symbols are made up of our language and our communication.
Mm-hmm.
There's visual literacy, visual and auditory discrimination, and other things that help them get on board. And I'm referencing an article that I found researching on empoweredparents.co that does a great job of listing at least 17 like early literacy skills that you can be aiding your child with or noticing from your child's learning experience. And I think that the Living Books does a great job kind of breaking down these points and really focusing on the early literacy part of the gameplay. I know that Jumpstart was very influenced by early educators. They had a lot of early educators working side by side with their gaming production to create.
Along with the development of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Gaming developers to create just the right educational game for specific age groups. And I really want to believe that Living Books did the same. I'm not positive. I didn't find that in my research, but it would be hard not to believe that someone with education background, you know, they had to be helping them out on this sort of thing. So the Living Books does a great job with children being able to recall events of a story,
mm-hmm.
being able to retell basic plots, beginning, middle, endings, maybe not specifics, but Living Books kind of motivates an early reader to be excited about a story, which is what you want in books, you know, especially children's books. You want children to be drawn in. You want mm-hmm. them to be excited about the text, about the storyline, about the illustrations. That's what's helping to build the foundation for early literacy skills, is the excitement to read.
Mm-hmm.
And when you pick up a children's storybook and it is colorful and it is easy to follow and it is enticing in many ways, you are motivating a child to find a love of reading, which is a foundation of our communication.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we start teaching and learning communication as early as infants by babbling and repeating sounds of one another. And, you know, reading to small children is one of the biggest ways to create pre-reading skills by influencing a love for books. I think Living Books does a good job of expanding their audience. Living Books also does a great job with picture reading. This is a, you know, important part when a child learns to tell a story just by using the pictures of the books. And I think that the Living Books are really combining this age and stage with, you know, visualizing and learning text, that text has meaning on a page. You see the words being highlighted and you know that they're being spoken, and that's important. Mm-hmm. But if you are an early reader or a pre-reader and you can't keep up with that, the Living Books entices you and keeps you engaged in other ways by picture reading, by looking at the picture, by engaging with the picture and the illustrations and seeing those animations and having those fun sound effects and pulling the reader into the story even more. You know, a child can learn to deduce from the information in the pictures, and, you know, they can also use the pictures for sequencing. They can put the story in order based on the pictures. They don't need to read the words. They can look at visual cues and be able to understand what's going on and take meaning from that story, even if they can't take meaning from the actual text. Mm-hmm. They're still reading. They're using a form of literacy.
That's interesting. Right. I never thought of it that way. Mm-hmm. That looking at picture books is just another form of reading. Now, real quick, you weren't quite sure if teachers had a hand in it. They did. Mark Schlichting, I was just double checking. I double checked on Wikipedia, so y'all should check the source as well. But I've looked at a bunch of the sources from there, and they all add up. Schlichting referenced a lot of teachers' feedback specifically, and that influenced their decision to have, there's essentially like three core concepts when designing a living book. One of them being I'm reading this from an old Silicon Valley, Silicon Valley ACM SIGGRAPH, which is like a convention panel. I don't know exactly what it was, but it was legit. So this was an interview with Schlichting back in 1993. And the three basic concepts for Living Books. Number one, nobody wants to read the manual. Software should work with non-readers, kids 3 years old and up. Like kind of what you're saying right there. Must do interface testing with naive users. Don't need to read to use a Living Book. Agent comes on screen and gives spoken instructions, which is why you were saying, you mentioned a narrator reading, but also when you get to that main page, it's usually Arthur, at least in the examples for the games we played, it's Arthur telling you, hey, you can click over here if you want to be read to, or you can click over here to play the game type of thing. The second core tenet or core design concept was nobody wants to wait, and it's critical for the acceptance by kids. Some original CD titles flopped because they were too slow. Tests showed that if the delay was more than a second, kids would just click again, expecting a response, sometimes less than a second. And the third one was everybody wants to be in control. There are no quote-unquote wrong answers in Living Books, and this keeps it fun.
Yep. So they're doing such a great job of being accessible to children and readers and pre-readers of any age, and they're keeping in mind the target audience, you know, by utilizing faster paced kind of click and response techniques and adding the mini games that are targeting their audience. You know, matching is a great game for early readers and early learners. Sequencing and board games, even, you know, just all of it encompasses a lot of skills and ticks off a lot of interests of early readers. And I think they do a wonderful job of engaging children, not to mention the classic that the Arthur series by Mark Brown is. I think they do a wonderful job picking the stories and making them into an accessible, engaging game that is reading to you, that is teaching early literacy in many ways. and for many types of learners. And I think it's a wonderful tool for children, family, mm-hmm. and early learners.
Do you see anything that, from what you experienced and what you've seen our daughter play, is there anything that you would recommend for improvements? Not like they're actively working on these anymore.
Right.
But, you know, this is from the 90s, but just out of curiosity, like, I think it's still good to look at the positives mm-hmm. of things, but also maybe see, you know, constructive criticism. Like, where do you see anything that they could focus on that might be a little, that would improve it?
From what I've witnessed and played through the Arthur series of the Living Books, I think they did a phenomenal job of just getting the point across, getting children reading more, getting kids engaged in literacy better. Arthur is such a household name, and him being able to come from your books and your television screen mm-hmm. onto an interactive portal that you can now be a part of, I think they just nailed it on the head. And I don't see a lot of room for improvement.
They
did their research. They tested on the right subjects. And I think because of that, because they were so mindful of their target audience and who this game really was for, that, you know, they put a lot of thought into it and made it the right way.
Now, my last question for you before we start wrapping this whole this Christmas episode up. Christmas Eve, this episode's coming out, by the way.
Yeah, only one more to sleep till Christmas.
After all, there's only one more sleep till Christmas Day. Believe it or not, listeners, we don't spend our days being this cheesy, singing songs to each other.
Well, you might not, but I am surrounded by small humans, so
you sing a lot.
We do sing a lot of songs. We read a lot of books.
Their current favorite song is Sisters from White Christmas.
Our daughter really enjoys the Sisters bit. The other child I watch has no idea what's going on, but enjoys the thought of playing Sisters because that's exciting.
That's fun.
When you don't have a sister, you play a sister.
But yeah, so my last question for you is, what are your opinions on it from, like, watching and playing what you did of it? Just, like, in general, this isn't necessarily, like, from an educational perspective, but just kind of in general, what were your overall vibes with it?
Personally, I really enjoyed them.
Mm.
I think they were fun. They were nostalgic, even though I did not play Living Books as a small child like you did. Mm-hmm. I don't have any personal nostalgia linked to these games, but the fact that we focused on Arthur, which is a really fun book series that I can relate to and I have fond memories of reading, was fun and exciting to jump into his world. It was a fun time overall. It was a little slow, but that's because, you know, I am a grown woman and these games are for children. Mm-hmm. Would I pull these out to play for the heck of it? Probably not.
Yeah.
I would rather play other nostalgic games
like Mr. Potato
Head. Mr. Potato Head's Adventure, Great Veggie Valley, something.
Whatever it is, yeah.
That's something that I would pop in before any of the Living Books, unless I found one of my favorite childhood
Stella
books.
Stella Luna?
I mean, I liked that, but I didn't really know that that was a book until I was in college and we brought it in for class one day. Yeah,
okay.
I did not read that one as a child.
Oh, I didn't know that. Anyway.
But I would have to look through the list of all of the Living Books and kind of browse through to see if there was one that really struck me that I would want to pull this out and play with. But I don't think my time was wasted going through these Living Books.
I hope not, because we just recorded a podcast on it.
Yeah, I mean, definitely not wasted time with you ever. But, you know, it was a really fun experience kind of going back in time, looking at the early kind of Living Book experiences, mm-hmm. which were comparable to reading a book from the library, going to your local library, checking out your Arthur book. Maybe you checked out Arthur's glasses, which is the first of the series when Arthur still had his long nose and the illustrations were just subpar.
A little terrifying.
They were quite
least.
Scary.
They're a little scary.
But, you know, the later games felt like you were jumping through a screen and entering Arthur's world on the television. It was kind of fun seeing that growth and development from the first games developed for Living Books to the more recent adventures like Arthur's Computer Adventure. Overall, I think they're really fun. I think our kid is going to have a great time with them when she's a little older and can understand a little better. I think they would be a fun tool to utilize and treat herself with and shake things up with. And, you know, we shouldn't put her in front of this screen to learn how to read.
No, agreed.
I think it's a really fun extra way to engage a child in literacy.
Now, I'm going to have to show her the Sega Pico.
Next. Oh, gosh, no.
Come on.
Wasn't this enough?
No, it's never enough. Educational, edutainment. Oh, my gosh. No.
But we have to play Potato Head first.
We got to find. We did kind of find a way to play it totally legally.
I don't know what it is, but I really just won't play Potato Heads. And it's going to be like, you know, we're going to open it up and I'm going to be like, this is it. But there's just more nostalgia focused on that
maybe,
one for me.
Maybe I can reach out to the people over on Zoom platform, see if there's a way that they can get it back up and running. I have no idea, because there's licensing stuff, because Potato Head's like, what? I don't know if it's owned by Hasbro or whatever, but it's, you know.
Yeah. Listen, I love dressing up that potato on the screen as a lovely princess ballerina.
That's how you play
that's
it,
That's what
man.
It's all about. And I hope that, you know, our kid can open these living books and have this kind of nostalgia that I'm experiencing now and you probably experience a lot because of all of your gaming history and upbringing. But overall, I think the living books did a great job. I am thankful that they exist. I think it's a wonderful tool and a really fun thing.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you liked it, and I know you well enough to know that you wouldn't just say that just to be nice to me. 9 times out of 10, if you don't like something, you go, and then don't, if something's straight out of, like, Pitch Perfect, just don't answer.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, obviously, for my own final thoughts, I love these. I can't look at these objectively, which is kind of why I wanted to have you on, just to see, like, I thought it'd be interesting, like I said, to hear about this from a more educational perspective, like someone who actually went to school for this and has a background in this, as opposed to a schmuck like me who just has nostalgia for it. So
yeah, you schmuck, what are you doing here?
I mean, for some reason people listen to me,
some reason,
and you should be grateful, otherwise I'd be talking to you about all these games.
Listeners, I am beyond grateful for you. You don't even know how beautiful a soul you are for taking your time to listen to my husband. Thank you for giving him this platform and this outlet.
It's honestly super helpful. But yeah, so I love these books. I love these games. I can't not love them. They're just fun. And I've been meaning to cover these in earnest for a while. Like I said, I did the episode with Mickey Mantle about almost 2 years ago. And even that one was recorded in like 2020. And it just got delayed due to me, just due to some scheduling issues. So you can, if you're interested, you can go back and check that episode out if you want to learn a little bit more. And there's a lot of information on living books out there. There's a lot of stuff that you can dig into. And we just didn't really have time to for this because we wanted to focus on the games and just kind of talk about the specifics. But the Living Books has a rich history. Maybe I'll do like a mini episode on just like a really deep dive on Living Books or something like that for Patreon or something like that. So if that interests you, if that interests anyone, I might be doing that over on Patreon. So yeah, that's it. That's all. I think that we're ready to wrap up this episode. Courtney, do you have any? I don't think you have any social media, but just in case, do you have any social media you want to plug?
No, I don't have any plugs.
That's Courtney.
I don't. No, I don't have any social media plugs.
All right. As usual for me, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. It's Blue Sky and Twitch @StillLoadingPod on all those places. If you want to support the show, you can do so in a number of ways. You can give it a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever podcasting app you use, because that makes me feel warm and fuzzy, and I like feeling warm and fuzzy. And, you know, it makes it so that way my wife doesn't have to listen to me as often. So if you want to help her, give her a 5-star rating or review on Apple Podcasts.
Much appreciated.
If you want to support the show monetarily, if you so choose, patreon.com/stillloadingpod. For $1 a month, you'll get all the episodes a little bit early with better audio quality, as well as access to patron voting rights. Every quarter, I put up a poll and patrons help guide the direction of the show. So if you would like to be a part of that, that can all be found at the $1 level. But there's more. At the $4 level, you'll get everything I mentioned prior, plus access to 2 mini bonus episodes. And then at the $5 level, you'll get everything I mentioned prior, the many episodes, the early access, the patron voting rights, as well as access to Still Bonding, which is my monthly James Bond podcast where me and a bunch of friends bond over 007. So if that interests you, patreon.com/stillowningpod. And the final shout out is the Bit by Bit Foundation. The Bit by Bit Foundation is a nonprofit organization whose mission is to put video games and video game consoles in the hands of kids receiving inpatient care at hospitals. So if you want to support them, go to bitbybitfoundation.org and consider donating. That is all the time I have for you on this episode of Still Loading. Courtney, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for letting me join you.
This was a lot of fun. And with all that said, listeners, I will see you all next time.
Merry Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Merry Christmas, you filthy animals.